Pity we all dried up, I says, rising to make a move.
Aye, too right,
Johnny Swan says, quieter now. It's time I wasn't here. Chapter 36. Winter in West Granton. Tommy looks well. It's terrifying. He's gonna die. Sometime between the next few weeks and next 15 years, Tommy will be no more. The chances are that I'll be exactly the same. The difference is, we ken this with Tommy. All right, Tommy, I says. You look so well.
Aye, says.
Tommy's sitting in a battered armchair. The air smells of damp and rubbish that should have been put out ages ago.
How you feeling?
No bad.
Want to talk about it?
I have to ask. No really, he says, like he does. I sit down awkwardly in an identical chair. It feels hard and has springs coming through. Many years ago, this was some rich cunt's chair. It's had at least a couple of decades in poor homes, though. Now it's winded up with Tommy. Now I see that Tommy doesn't look so well. There's something missing, some part of him. It's as if he's an incomplete jigsaw puzzle. It's more than shock or depression. It's like a bit of Tommy's already died, and I'm mourning for it. I realise now that death is usually a process rather than an event. People generally die by degrees, incrementally. They rot away slowly in homes and hospitals or places like this. Tommy can't get out of West Granton. He's blown things with his ma. This is one of the varicose vein flats, called so because of the plastered cracks all over its facing. Tommy got it through the council's hotline. 15,000 people on the waiting list and nobody wanted this one. It's a prison. It's not really the council's fault. The government made them sell off all the good houses, leaving the dross for the likes of Tommy. It makes perfect sense politically. There's no votes for the government down here, so why bother doing anything for people who aren't going to support you? Morally, it's another thing. What's morality got to do with politics, but it's all about poppy.
How's London, he asks.
No bad, Tommy. Really just the same as up here, Ken.
Aye, I bet,
he says sarcastically. Plager was painted on the heavy plywood-enforced door in big black letters. Also HIV-er and junkie. Draft pack kids will harass anybody. Nobody's said anything to Tommy's face yet. Tommy's a tidy bastard. He believes in what Begbie calls the discipline of the baseball bat. He's also got hard mates, like beggars, and no-say hard mates like me. In spite of this, Tommy will become more vulnerable to persecution. His friends will decline in their numbers as his needs increase. The inverse or perverse mathematics of life.
You took the test, he says.
Aye.
Clear?
Aye. Tommy looks at us. It's like he's angry and pleading, both at the same time.
You used more than me, and you shared works. Sick boys, Keesbos, Ramies, Spuds, Swannies. You used Matty's, for fuck's sake. Tell us you never used Matty's works.
I never shared, Tommy. Every cunt says that, but I never shared. No in the galleries anyway, I tell them. Funny, I'd forgotten all about Keesbo. He'd been inside now for a couple of year. Been meaning to go and visit the cunt for donks. I ken that I'll never get round to it, though.
Bullshit! Cunt! You fucking shared!
Tommy leans forward. He's starting to greet. I remember thinking that if he did, I might know. All I feel, though, is an ugly, choking anger. I never shared, I shake my head. He sits back and smiles to himself. No even looking at us as he talks reflectively, now without any bitterness. Funny how it all works out, eh? It was you and Spud and Sick Boy and Swanee and that got us into the H. I used to sit and have a bevy with Second Prize and Franco and laugh at yous,
Call yous all the daft cunts under the sun.
Then I split for Lizzie, mind. Went to your bit. Asked you for a hit. I thought, fuck it. I'll try anything once. Been trying it once ever since.
I remember that. Christ, it was only a few months ago. Some poor bastards are just so much more predisposed to addiction with certain drugs than others. Like second prize with pish. Tommy took to the skag with a vengeance. Nae cunt can really control it, but I've known some fuckers like myself to accommodate it. I've kicked a few times now. Kicking and using again is like going to prison. Every time you go to jail, the probability of you ever becoming free for that kind of life decreases. It's the same every time you go back to smack. You decrease your chances of ever being able to deal without it. Was it me that encouraged Tommy to take that first shot just by having the gear there? Possibly. Probably. How guilty did that make us? Guilty enough. I'm really sorry, Tommy. I dinna ken what to fucking do, Mark. What am I gonna do? I just sit there. He'd slightly bowed. I wanted to tell Tommy, get on with your life. It's all you can do. Look after yourself. You might not get bad. Look at Davy Mitchell. Davy's one of Tommy's best mates. He's HIV and he's never used skag in his puff. Davy's okay though. He leads a normal life. Well, as normal a life as any cunt I ken leads. But I know that Tommy can't afford to heat this gaff. He isn't Davy Mitchell, never mind Derek Jarman. Tommy can't put himself in a bubble, live in the warm, eat good fresh food, keep his mind stimulated with new challenges. He will only live 5 or 10 or 15 years before he's crushed by pneumonia or cancer. Tommy will not survive winter in West Granton.
I'm sorry, mate. I'm really sorry. I just repeat.
Got any gear? He asks, raising his head and looking straight at me. I'm clean now, Tommy. When I tell him, he doesn't even sneer.
Sub us then, mate. I'm expecting a rent check.
I dig into my pockets and produce 2 crumpled fivers. I'm thinking about Matty's funeral. It's odds on Tommy's next, and there's fuck all anybody can do about it. Especially me. He takes the money. Our eyes meet and something flashes between us. It's something I can't define, but it's something really good. It's there just for a second, then it's gone.
Chapter 37 A Scottish Soldier. Johnny Swan examines his close-shaven head in the bathroom mirror. His long, filthy hair had been shorn off a few weeks back. Now he had to get rid of this growth on his chin. Shaving was a drag when you only had one leg, and Johnny still hadn't quite got his balance sorted out. However, after a few scares, he managed what is a passable attempt. He was determined that he'd never go back into that wheelchair again. That was for sure.
Back on the mooch,
he says to himself as he studies his face in the mirror. Johnny looked clean. It was not a nice feeling, and the process had caused him a great deal of discomfort, but people expect standards from an old soldier. He starts whistling the tune, A Scottish Soldier. Indulging himself further, he gives his reflection a stiff, regimental salute. The bandage on his stump gives Johnny some cause for concern. It looks filthy. Mrs. Harvey, the community nurse, is coming today to change it, doubtless with a few accompanying choice words on personal hygiene. He examines his remaining leg. It was never the best of the two. That knee was dodgy, the remnant of a footballing incident many moons ago. It'll get dodgier still as the sole bearer of his weight. Johnny thinks that he should have injected into the artery in this leg. Let this one have been the cunt that went gangrenous and got hacked off by the surgeon. The curse of being right-sided, he reflects. Outside in the cold streets, he swings and lurches towards the Waverley Station. Each step is a cruel one. The pain doesn't come from the extremity of his stump, but seems to be all over his body. However, the two methadone jellies and the barbiturates he has swallowed take the edge off it. Johnny sets up his pitch at the Market Street exit. His large piece of cardboard reads in black letters, "Falklands Veteran. I lost my leg for my country. Please help." A junkie called Silver, Johnny doesn't know his real name, approaches him in freeze-frame motions.
"Any skag, Swanee?" he asks.
"Nothing happening, mate. Ramey's on for Saturday or so I hear."
"Saturday's nae good," Silver wheezes. "There's a fucking ape on my back wants feeding."
"The white swan here's a businessman, Silver," Johnny points at himself. "If he had merchandise to punt, he'd do just that."
Silver looks downcast. A filthy black overcoat hangs loosely on his grey, emaciated flesh.
"Blutered off form a methy script," he states,
neither looking for sympathy nor expecting it. Then a slight glint comes into his dead eyes.
"Hey, Swanee, do you make any poppy out of that?"
As one door shuts, another opens. Johnny smiles, his teeth a rotting mass in his mouth.
"I make mair hires doing this than I do on the punt. Now, if you'll excuse us, Silver, I've got a fucking living to earn here. An upright soldier like myself canny be seen talking to junkies. See you around."
Silver barely registers his comments, let alone takes offence.
"I'll just head down to the clinic then. Some cunt might sell us a jelly."
"Au revoir,"
Johnny shouts at his back. He does steady business. Some people furtively drop coins into his hat. Others, resentful at the intrusion of misery into their lives, turn away or resolutely look ahead. Women give more than men. Young people more than their elders. People who appear to be of the most modest means seem more generous than the affluent-looking. A fiver lands in the hat.
"God bless you, sir," Johnny acknowledges. "Not at all," a middle-aged man says. "We owe you, lads. It must be terrible to suffer that loss so young." "I've nae regrets. You canny allow yourself to be bitter, pal. That's my philosophy anyway. I love my country. I'd do it all again. Besides, I regard myself as one of the lucky uns. I came back. I lost some good mates in that swedge at Goose Green, I can tell ye."
Johnny lets his eyes take on a glazed, faraway look. He almost believed himself. He turned back to the man.
"Still, meeting people like yourself, we remember, we care. That makes it all worthwhile."
"Good luck," the man says softly, before turning and mounting the steps up to Market Street.
"Fucking reg cunt," Johnny mutters to himself, shaking his bowed head as spasms of light laughter ripple up his sides.
He makes £26.78 after a couple of hours. It's not bad going, and it's easy work. Johnny's good at waiting. Even British Rail on a bad day couldn't fuck up his junky karma. However, withdrawal gives advance notice of its cruel intentions with an icy burn which causes his pulse to kick up a gear and his pores to excrete a rich, toxic sweat. He's about to pack up and leave when a thin, frail woman approaches him.
"Were you a Royal Scot, son?"
"Ma Brian was a Royal Scot, Brian Laidlaw."
"Marines, missus," Johnny shrugs.
"Brian never came back, God love him. 21 he was, my laddie. A fine laddie and all."
The woman's eyes are welling up with tears. Her voice lowers to a concentrated hiss, which is all the more pitiful for its impotence.
"You know, son, I'll hate that Thatcher till my dying day. There isn't a day goes by when I dinna curse her."
She takes out her purse and, producing a £20 note, crushes it into Johnny's hand.
Here, son, here. It's all I've got, but I want you to have it.
She breaks into a sob and almost staggers away from him. It was like she'd been stabbed.
God bless ye, Johnny Swan shouts after her. God bless the Royal Jocks.
Then he thrashes his hands together at the prospect of adding some cyclozine to the methadone he already has. Psychomethy cocktail. His ticket to better times. That wee private heaven the uninitiated pour scorn on, but they could never conceive of its bliss. Albo has a stack of cyclozine, prescribed for his cancer. Johnny will visit his sick friend this afternoon. Albo needs Johnny's jellies as much as Johnny needs his psychos. A mutual coincidence of wants. Yes, God bless the Royal Jocks, and God bless the NHS.
Part 7. Exit. Chapter 38. Station to Station. It is a foul and dreich night. Filthy clouds hang overhead, waiting to spew their dark load on the shuffling citizens below, for the umpteenth time since the break of dawn. The bus station concourse is like a social security office turned inside out and doused with oil. A lot of young people living on big dreams and small budgets stand somberly in line at the London rank. The only cheaper way down is by thumb. The bus has come from Aberdeen with a stop at Dundee. Begbie stoically checks the seat reservation tickets, then fixes a malevolent glare at the people already on the bus. Turning away, he looks back at the Adidas holdall at his feet. Renton, out of Begbie's earshot, turns to Spud and nods towards their uptight friend. The cunt's just hoping some fuckers grabbed your seats. Gee 'em an excuse to cause hassle. Spud smiles and raises his eyebrows. Looking at him, Renton reflects, you'd never guess how high the stakes are. This is the big one, no doubt about it. He'd needed that shot to keep his nerves straight. It had been his first one in months. Begbie turns around, his nerves jangling, and shoots them an angry grimace, almost as if he can sense their irreverence.
Where the fuck, sick boy? Eh, I'm scoobied, like say, Spud shrugs.
He'll be here, Renton says, nodding at the Adidas bag. That's 20% of his gear you're huddin'.
The shot of an attack of paranoia. Keep your fucking voice down, you fucking rag!
Begbie hisses at Renton. He looks around, staring at the other passengers, feeling a desperate need for one, just one, to make eye contact, to give him a target to unleash the fury within him which threatens to overwhelm him and fuck the consequences.
No, he had to stay in control. There was too much at stake. There was everything at stake.
There is nobody looking at Begbie, though. Those who are not oblivious to him can feel the vibes he is giving out. They employ that special talent people have, pretending nutters are invisible. Even his companions won't meet his gaze. Renton has pulled his green baseball cap down over his eyes. Spud, wearing a Republic of Ireland football strip, is eyeing a backpacker who has blonde hair and has just removed her pack to give him a view of her tight-arsed jeans. Second prize, who stands a bit apart from the others, is just drinking steadily, protective of the sizable carry-out which sits at his feet in two white plastic bags. Over the concourse, behind the pillbox which calls itself a pub, Sick Boy is talking to a girl named Molly. She is a prostitute and is HIV positive. She sometimes hangs around the station at night looking for punters. Molly had been in love with Sick Boy since he necked with her in a seedy disco bar in Leith a few weeks back. Sick Boy had made a drunken point about HIV transmission and, to illustrate it, had spent most of the night French kissing her.
Later he had a bad attack of nerves and brushed his teeth half a dozen times before turning in for a sleepless, anxiety-filled night. Sick Boy had been peeking out at his friends from behind the pub. He'd keep the bastards waiting. He wants to make sure that no lab dicks pounce before they get on the bus. If that happens, these cunts can go down alone.
"Sub us a 10-spot, doll," he asks Molly, not forgetting that he has a 3.5 grand stake in the contents of the Adidas bag.
These are assets, however. This is cash flow, which is always a problem. "Here you are." The unquestioning way Molly goes for her purse almost touches Sick Boy. Then, with some bitterness, he notes the health of a wad and curses inwardly for not making it 20.
"Cheers, babes. Well, I'd better leave you to your punters. The smoke beckons."
He tousles her curly hair and kisses her. This time, though, a derisory brush on the cheek.
"Phone us when you get back, Simon,"
she shouts after him, watching his lean but sturdy body bounce away from her. He turns around.
"You just try stopping us, babes. You just try stopping us. Look after yourself now."
He winks at her and flashes an open, heartwarming smile before turning away.
"Fucked up we hoor," he mutters under his breath, his face freezing in a contemptuous scowl.
Molly was an amateur, nowhere near cynical enough for the game she was in. A total victim, he thinks, with an odd mixture of compassion and scorn. He turns the corner and bounds over to the others, head swishing from side to side, trying to detect the presence of the police. He is not amused at what he sees as they prepare to board the bus. Begbie curses him for his lateness. You always had to watch that Raj, but with the stakes as high as they were, that meant he'd be even more uptight than usual. He remembered the bizarre contingency plans of violence that Begbie had hatched at the impromptu party they'd had last night. His temper could send them all to prison for life. Second prize was in an advanced state of inebriation, to be expected. On the other hand, what loose-mouthed, drunkard's talk had the cunt been coming out with prior to being here? If he can't remember where he is, how the fuck can he be expected to remember what he says? This is such a fucking dodgy scam, he reflects, allowing a shiver of anxiety to convulse through him. What chews Sick Boy up the most, however, is the state of Spud and Renton. They were obviously smacked out of their eyeballs. It was just like these bastards to fuck up. Renton, who has now been clean for ages, since long before he packed in his London job and came back up, could not resist that uncut Colombian brown Seeker had supplied them with. It was the real thing, he had argued, a once-in-a-lifetime hit for an Edinburgh junkie used to cheap Pakistani heroin. Spud, as always, had gone along for the ride. That was Spud. His effortless ability to transform the most innocent of pastimes into criminality always amazed Sick Boy. Even in his ma's womb, you would have had to define Spud less as a fetus, more as a set of dormant drug and personality problems. He'd probably draw the polis onto them through knocking a salt cellar out of the little chef. Forget Begbie, he bitterly reflects. If one cunt is going to mess up the gig, it'll be Spud. Sick Boy looks harshly at Second Prize, this nickname resulting from his drug-fueled fantasy that he could fight, and the attendant disastrous results. Second Prize's sport had not been boxing, but football. He was a Scotland schoolboy international star of remarkable ability, who went south to Manchester United at the age of 16. By then, he already had an embryonic drink problem. One of soccer's unsung miracles was how Second Prize had managed to wring 2 years from the club before being kicked back to Scotland. The conventional wisdom was that Second Prize had wasted a great talent. Sick Boy understood the harsher truth, however. Second Prize was a mass of despair. In terms of his life as a whole, footballing ability was a frivolous deviation rather than alcoholism a cruel curse. They file onto the bus, Renton and Spud moving in the smackhead's freeze-frame manner. they are as disorientated by the sequence of events as they are by the junk. There they were, pulling off the big one and heading for a break in Paris. All they had to do was to convert the smack into hard cash, which had all been set up by Andreas in London. Sick Boy, though, had greeted them like a sinkful of dirty dishes. He was obviously in a bad mood, and Sick Boy believed that the nasty things in life should be shared. As he climbs onto the bus, Sick Boy hears a voice call his name. Simon! Know that hoor again, he curses under his breath, before noting a younger girl. He shouts, Get my seat, Franco, I'll just be a minute. Taking his seat, Begbie feels hatred, fused with more than a twinge of jealousy, as he watches a young girl in a blue cagoule hold hands with Sick Boy. That cunt and his fucking a boot with Fanny'll fuck us all up, he snarls at Renton, who looks bemused. Begbie tries to define the girl's shape through the cagoule. He admired her before. He fantasizes what he'd like to do with her. He notes her face is even prettier when understated without makeup. It is hard to focus on Sick Boy, but Begbie sees his mouth turned down and his eyes opened wide in contrived sincerity. Begbie gets more and more anxious until he is ready to just get up and drag Sick Boy onto the bus. As he goes to haul himself out of the seat, he sees Sick Boy is coming back onto the vehicle, staring balefully out of the windows. They are sitting at the back of the bus, beside the chemical toilet, which already smells of spilled pish. Second Prize has cornered the back seat for himself and his carry-out. Spud and Renton sit in front of him, with Begbie and Sick Boy ahead of them.
That was Tam McGregor's wee lassie, Sick Boy, eh?
Renton's face grins idiotically at him through the gap between the seat's headrests.
Aye. He's still fucking hassling ye? Begbie asks. The cunt's got a lamb on because I've been poking his wee slutty a daughter. Meanwhile, he's playing stoat the ball with every wee hairy that drinks in his shitey club, fucking hypocrite. Pulled ye up outside the fucking Fiddlers, I heard. They fucking tell us ye shat your fucking load,
Begbie mocks.
Like fuck I did, we tell you that. The cunt says to us, if you lay a finger on her, I just goes, lay a finger on her. I've been pimping it out for fucking months, you cunt.
Renton smirks softly at this, and Second Prize, who didn't really hear it, laughs loudly. He is not as yet pickled enough to feel completely comfortable foregoing the bare bones of social contact. Spud says nothing, but grimaces as the vice-like grip of junk withdrawal squeezes harder on his brittle bones. Begbie is unconvinced that Sick Boy would have the bottle to stand up to McGregor.
Shite! You wouldn't fucking mess with that cunt. Fuck off! Jimmy Busby was with us. That cunt McGregor shites it for the buzz bomb. He's shit scared the other casuals. The last thing he wants is a squad of the family swedging in his club. Jimmy Busby, he's no a fucking hard cunt, a fucking shiting cunt. I stoted that rag in the Dean. You mind of that time, Rents? Hey, Rents, mind the time I panelled that Busby cunt?
Begbie glances over the seat for support, but Renton is starting to feel like Spud. A shudder twists through his body, and a grim nausea hits him. He can only nod unconvincingly, rather than provide the elaboration Begbie is looking for.
That was years ago. You wouldn't do it now, Sick Boy contended. We're fucking Whitney, eh? Think of fucking Whitney, you fucking rag,
Begbie challenges aggressively.
It's all of this shite anyway,
Sick Boy meekly counters, using one of his classic tactics. If you can't win the fine detail of the argument, then rubbish its context.
That cunt Kane's naughty fucking mess, Begbie says in a low growl.
Sick Boy does not respond, knowing that this was a warning by proxy, directed at him, through the absent Busby. He realizes that he's been pushing his luck. Spud Murphy's face is smeared against the glass window. He sits in silent misery, lashing sweat and feeling like his bones are grinding against each other. Sick Boy turns to Begbie, seizing the opportunity to make a common cause.
These cunts, Franco, he nods backwards. Says they would stay clean. Lying bastards. Fuck us all up.
His tone is a mixture of disgust and self-pity, as if he is resigned to the fact that his lot in life is to have all his moves sabotaged by the weak fools he was unfortunate enough to have to call his friends. Nonetheless, Sick Boy fails to strike an empathetic chord with Begbie, who dislikes his attitude even more than he disapproves of Renton and Spud's behaviour.
Stop fucking moaning. You've fucking been there often enough.
No, for ages. These nondy cunts never grow up.
So you'll no be wanting any fucking speed then, Begbie teased, dabbing at some salty granules in silver foil.
Sick Boy really wants some Billy Whiz to cut down the hideous travelling time. He is fucked if he is going to plead with Begbie, however. He sits staring ahead, gently shaking his head and muttering under his breath, a wrenching anxiety in his guts, forcing his mind to flip through unresolved grievance after unresolved grievance. He then springs up and goes to grab a can of McEwen's export from Second Prize's pile.
I tell you that you should have got your own carry out.
Second Prize's face resembled that of an ugly bird whose eggs are under threat from a stalking predator.
One can then, you tight cunt, fuck's sakes!
Sick Boy slaps his forehead with his palm in exasperation. Second Prize reluctantly hands a can over, which, in the event, Sick Boy cannot drink. He has not eaten for a while, and the fluid feels heavy and sickly in his raw guts. Behind him, Renton's slide into the misery of withdrawal continues apace. He knows he has to act. This means holding out on Spud. However, there was no sympathy in business, and much less in this particular one than in any other. Turning to his partner, he says,
"Man, I've got a fucking bad rock in my arse. I've got to spend a bit of time in the bog."
Spud shoots to life for a second.
"You're no hudding her, ye?"
"A witty fuck," Renton convincingly snaps. Spud turns and melts miserably back into the window. Renton goes into the toilet and secures the door. He wipes the pish off the rim of the aluminium pan. It is not hygiene that concerns him, merely the avoidance of a wet sensation on his creeping skin. On the tiny sink, he places his cooking spoon, syringe, needle, and cotton balls. Producing a small packet of browny-white powder from his pocket, he tips the contents diligently into his prized piece of cutlery. Sucking 5 mils of water into the syringe and squirting it slowly into the spoon, Renton takes care to avoid flushing away the grains. His trembling hand firms up with the concentration only junk preparation can facilitate. Passing the flame from the Benidorm plastic lighter under the spoon, he stirs at the stubborn dregs with the needle tip until he has produced an injectable solution. The bus lurches violently, but he moves with it. His junkie's vestibular sense tuned in, like radar, to every bump and bend on the A1. Not a precious drop is spilled as he lowers the cotton ball onto the cooking spoon. Sticking the needle into the bowl, he sucks the rusty liquid into the chamber. He pulls off his belt, cursing as the studs catch in the tabs of his jeans. He violently jerks it free, feeling as if his insides are folding in on themselves. Tightening the belt around his arm just below a puny bicep, he clamps yellowing teeth onto the leather to hold it fast. The sinew in his neck strains as he maintains the position, teasing up through patient, probing taps a reluctant, healthy vein. A brief flicker of hesitancy glows in the corner of his mind, only to be snuffed cruelly by a twisting spasm which convulses his sick body. He zeroes in, watching the tender flesh give way to the penetrating steel. He pushes the plunger part of the way home for a split second before sucking back to fill the chamber with blood. He then releases the tension in the belt and flushes everything into his vein. He raises his head and savors the hit. He sits for a period which could be minutes or hours before standing up and looking at himself in the mirror.
"You're fucking gorgeous," he observes, kissing the reflection,
feeling the cold glass against his hot lips. He turns and puts his cheek on the glass, then licks at it with his tongue. Then he stands back and adjusts his features into a forced mask of misery. Spud's eyes would be on him as soon as he opened the door. He must contrive to act sick, which is not going to be easy. Second Prize has drunk off a crippling hangover and is having what would have been described a second wind, had his constant state of inebriation and withdrawal not rendered such a term superfluous. Begbie, realizing they are well on their way and have not been intercepted by the Lothian and Borders Constabulary, the Labdix, is more relaxed. Victory was in sight. Spud takes a troubled junky sleep. Renton feels a little more animated. Even Sick Boy senses that things are going well and unwinds. The fragile unity is shattered when Sick Boy and Renton have an argument about the merits of the pre- and post-Velvet Underground achievements of Lou Reed. Sick Boy is uncharacteristically tongue-tied under an onslaught from Renton. "No, no." He weakly shakes his head and turns away, devoid of inspiration to counter Renton's arguments. Renton had stolen the cloak of indignation that Sick Boy likes to wear on such occasions. Savoring his adversary's capitulation, Renton pulls his head back sharply and smugly, folding his arms in a gesture of triumphant belligerence, the way he'd once seen Mussolini do in an old newsreel. Sick Boy contents himself with checking out the other passengers. There are two old wifeys in front of him, who have been intermittently looking around with disapproving expressions and making clucking references to the language. They have, he notes, the old wifey smell of pish and sweat, partially obscured by layers of stale talcum. Opposite him sits an overweight couple in shell suits. Shell-suited bastards are another breed apart, he caustically thinks. They should be fucking exterminated. It surprised Sick Boy that the beggar did not have a shell-suit in his wardrobe. Once they coined in the dough, he thinks he'll treat the bastard to one, just for the crack. Additionally, he resolves to present Begbie with an American pit bull pup. Even if Begbie neglected it, it wouldn't go hungry with the bairn in the house. There was one rose amongst thorns on the bus, however. Sick Boy's eyes cease their critical scrutiny of his fellow passengers when they focus on the streaked blonde backpacker. She sits all by herself in front of the shell-suited couple. Renton feels full of mischief and pulls out the Benidorm lighter and starts burning Sick Boy's ponytail. Hair crackles, and yet another unpleasant smell mingles with the rest at the back of the bus. Sick Boy, realizing what is happening, springs round in his seat. "Fuck off!" he snarls, thrashing at Renton's now raised wrists. "Immature cunts!" he hisses as the laughter of Begbie, Second Prize, and Renton mocks him, ricocheting around the bus. Renton's intervention, though, gives Sick Boy the excuse he scarcely needs to leave them and join the backpacker. He pulls off his "Italians do it better" t-shirt, exposing a wiry, tanned torso. Sick Boy's mother is Italian, but he wears the t-shirt less to show pride in his origins as to wind up the others at his pretension. He pulls down his bag and rummages through its contents. There is a Mandela Day shirt, which was politically sound and rock enough, but too mainstream, too sloganistic. Worse, it was dated. He felt that Mandela would prove to be just another tedious old cunt once everybody got used to him being out of the jail. He only gave Hibernian FC European campaigners a cursory glance before rejecting it out of hand. The Sandinistas were also passé now. He settled for a fall t-shirt, which at least had the virtue of being white and would show off his Corsican tan to its best effect. Pulling it on, he moved over and slid into the seat beside the woman. "Excuse me. Sorry, I'm going to have to join you.
My travelling companion's behaviour is a touch immature for my taste. Renton observes, with a mixture of admiration and distaste, the metamorphosis of sick boy from waster into this woman's ideal man. Voice modulation and accent subtly change. An interested, earnest expression comes over his face as he fires seductively interrogative questions at his new companion. Renton winces as he hears sick boy say, "Yeah, I'm more of a jazz purist myself." "Sick boy's cracked it," he observes, turning to Begbie. "I'm fucking pleased for the cunt," Begbie says bitterly. "At least it fucking keeps the moosey-faced cunt away from us. Fucking Nondi cunt's done fuck all but fucking moan since we saw him. The cunt!" "Every cunt's a wee bit tense, Franco. There's a lot at stake. We did all that speed the other night there. Everybody's bound to be a wee bit para. Didn't he keep fucking sticking up for that cunt? Needs a fucking lesson in manners, that fucking wido. Might soon be fucking well getting it and all. Doesn't he fucking cost out to have manners?" Renton, realizing that the discussion cannot be fruitfully advanced, settles down into his seat, letting the gear massage him, unravel the knots, and smooth out the creases. It was quality stuff, all right. Begbie's bitterness towards sick boy is not so much fueled by jealousy, but resentment at his departure. He is missing sitting beside someone. He now has a big speed kick on. His mind flashes with insight after insight, which Begbie thinks are just too good not to share. He needs someone to talk at. Renton notes the danger signs. Behind him, second prize is snoring loudly. Begbie would get little from him. Renton pulls the baseball cap down over his eyes, while simultaneously nudging Spud awake. "You sleepin', Rents?" Begbie asks. Renton murmurs. "Spud!" "What?" says Spud irritably. It was a mistake. Begbie turns in the seat, resting on his knees. He overhangs Spud and starts to repeat an oft-told story. "So, I'm on top of it, Ken. Coping it, lights. Gone fucking rage and it's fucking screaming, lights. And I thinks, fuck me. This dirty cow's right fucking into it, lights. But it pushes us off, Ken. And she's bleeding out her fanny, Ken, like it's fucking rag week. And I'm about to say, that doesn't bother me. Especially no with a fucking root on like I had, I'm fucking telling you. Anyway, it turns out that the cunt's having a fucking miscarriage there and then."
"Yeah."
"Aye, and I'll fucking tell you something else, I know. Did I tell you about the time when me and Sean picked up the two fucking hounds in the Oblomov?"
"Yeah," Spud moans weakly, his face feeling like a cathode ray tube which is imploding in slow motion. The coach swings into the service station. While it provides Spud with some much-needed respite, second prize is not happy. Sleep had only just taken him, but the harsh lights of the bus are switched on, cruelly ripping him from his comforting oblivion. He wakes, disorientated, in an alcoholic stupor, bemused eyes unable to focus, ringing ears assaulted by a cacophony of indistinguishable voices, flapping, dried-up mouth unable to shut. He instinctively reaches for a purple can of Tennant's Super Lager, letting the sickly drink act as surrogate saliva. They slouch across the motorway's flyover bridge, persecuted by the cold, as well as the tiredness and drugs in their bodies. The exception is Sick Boy, who waltzes confidently ahead of them with the backpacker. In the garish Trusthouse 40 cafeteria, Begbie grabs Sick Boy by an arm and extracts him from the queue. "Dinny, you fucking rip off that bird. We're no wantin' a fucking polis swarming o' our us for a few hundred quid of some fucking student's holiday, poppy. No when we've got 18 fucking grand's worth of skag on us." "You think I'm fucking daft?" Sick Boy snaps, outraged, but at the same time confessing to himself that Begbie has provided him with a timely reminder.
He had been necking with the woman, but his bulging chameleon eyes were always frantically scanning, trying to work out where her money was stashed. The visit to the cafe had been his opportunity. Begbie was right, however. This was no time for a move like that. You couldn't always trust your instincts, Sick Boy reflected. He tears himself away from Begbie with an injured pout and rejoins his new girlfriend in the queue. Sick Boy starts to lose interest in the woman after this. He is finding it hard to maintain an acceptable level of concentration on her excited tales of going to Spain for 8 months before taking up a place on a law degree course at Southampton University. He gets the address of the hotel in London she is staying at, noting with some distaste that it seems to be a cheap King's Cross job rather than a more salubrious place in the West End, which he'd enjoy hanging out in for a day or two. He was supremely confident that he'd get a shag out of this woman once they got the business with Andreas settled. The bus eventually starts to roll through North London's brickwork suburbs. Sick Boy looks out nostalgically as they pass the Swiss Cottage, wondering whether a woman he knew still worked behind the bar. Doubtlessly not, he reasons. 6 months is quite a while behind the bar of a London pub. Even so early in the morning, the bus is reduced to a crawl as it reaches central London, and it takes a depressingly long time to wind down to Victoria bus station. They disembark like pieces of broken crockery being poured out of a packing case. A debate develops about whether they should go down to the railway station and get a Victoria Line tube up to Finsbury Park or jump a taxi. They decide that a taxi is a better bet than messing about through London with a load of smack. They squeeze into the Hackney cab, telling the talkative driver that they are down for the Pogues gig, which will take place in a tent in Finsbury Park. It provided ideal cover, as they all plan to go to the concert, combining pleasure with business, before heading to Paris for a break. The cab almost backtracks the way the bus had come in, prior to stopping at Andreas's hotel, which overlooks the park. Andreas, who came from a London Greek family, had inherited the hotel on the death of his father. Under the old man, the hotel had predominantly housed emergency homeless families. Local councils had the responsibility to find short-stay accommodation for people in such circumstances, and as the Finsbury Park district was sliced up between three London boroughs, Hackney, Haringey and Islington, business had been good. On taking over the hotel, however, Andreas saw that it could be even more lucrative as a knocking shop for London businessmen. While he never really hit the top end of the market he aimed at, he provided a safe haven for a small number of prostitutes. Mid-ranking city punters admired his discretion and the cleanliness and safety of his establishment. Sick Boy and Andreas had got to know each other through going out with the same woman, who had been mesmerized by the both of them. They hit it off instantly and worked a few scams together, mainly petty insurance fiddles and bank card frauds. On taking over the hotel, Andreas had started to distance himself from Sick Boy, deciding that he was now in a bigger league. However, Sick Boy had approached him about a batch of quality heroin he had got a hold of. Andreas was cursed with a dangerous fantasy and a timeless one, namely that he could hang around with villains to boost his ego, without paying an attendant price. The price Andreas paid was getting Pete Gilbert together with the Edinburgh Consortium. Gilbert was a professional who had worked in drug dealing for a long time. He'd buy and sell anything. For him it was strictly business, and he refused to differentiate it from any other entrepreneurial activity. State intervention in the form of police and courts merely constituted another business risk. It was, however, a risk worth taking, considering the supernormal profits. A classic middleman, Gilbert was, by nature of his contacts and his venture capital, able to procure drugs, hold them, cut them, and sell them to smaller distributors. Straight away, Gilbert clocks the Scottish guys as small-time wasters who have stumbled on a big deal. He is impressed, however, by the quality of their gear. He offers them £15,000, prepared to go as high as £17,000. They want £20,000, prepared to go as low as £18,000. The deal is clinched at £16,000. Gilbert will make £60,000 minimum once the gear is cut and distributed. He finds it tiresome negotiating with a bunch of fucked-up losers from the wrong side of the border. He'd rather be dealing with the person who sold it to them. If their supplier was desperate enough to punt such good gear to this squad of fuck-ups, then he didn't really understand the business. Gilbert could have turned him onto some real money. More than tiresome, it was dangerous. Despite their assurances to the contrary, it would be impossible, he decided, for this bunch of wasted jocks to ever be discreet. It was more than possible that the DS had stuck a tail on them. For that reason, he has two experienced punters outside in the car with their eyes peeled. Despite his reservations, he cultivated his new business associates. Anyone desperate enough to punt them this gear once could be daft enough to do it again. The deal concluded, Spud and Second Prize hit Soho to celebrate. They are typical new boys in town, attracted to that famous square mile like kids to a toy shop. Sick Boy and Begbie go to shoot what proves to be a competitive game of pool in the Sir George Robey with two Irish guys they team up with. London old stagers, they are contemptuous of their friend's fascination for Soho. All they'll get there is plastic policemen's hats, Union Jacks, Carnaby Street signs, and overpriced pintsy pish, Sick Boy scoffed. They'd get a cheaper fucking ride back at your mate's hotel. What the fuck do you call him? The Greek cunt? Andreas, but that's the last thing these cunts want, says Sick Boy, racking up the balls. And that fucker Rents. That's the umpteenth time he's tried to kick. Dos cunt chucked in a good job in Barry Flat down here or not. I think me and him will go our separate ways after this. It's a good job he's fucking back there, though. Some cunt's got to watch the fucking loot. I wouldn't trust Second Prize or Spud to look after it. Aye, Sick Boy says, wondering how he can ditch Begbie and get off in search of women's company. He wonders who he will call up, or whether he'll check out the backpacker. Whatever he decided, he'd move on soon. Back at Andreas's place, Renton is sick, but not quite as sick as he'd led them to believe. He looks out onto the back garden and sees Andreas cavorting with Sarah, his girlfriend. He looks back at the Adidas bag, stuffed full of cash, the first time Begbie has let it out of his sight. He turfs its contents out onto the bed. Renton has never seen so much money. Almost without thinking, he empties the contents of Begbie's head bag, putting them into the empty Adidas bag, then stuffs the cash into the head bag and puts his own clothes in on top of the money. Briefly, he glimpses out of the window. Andreas has his hand inside Sarah's purple bikini pants, and she is laughing and shrieking, "Dan, Andreas, Dan!" Gripping the head bag firmly, Renton turns and stealthily scuttles out of the room, down the stairs and along the hallway. He looks back briefly before striding out the door. If he bumped into Begbie now, he was finished. As soon as he lets that thought form consciously in his head, he almost collapses with fear. There is nobody in the street, however. He crosses the road. He hears chanting noises and freezes. A group of young guys in Celtic football tops, obviously down for the Pogues gig in the afternoon, are staggering towards him, out of their heads on alcohol. He walks tensely past them, although they ignore him, and to his relief he sees a 253 bus coming. He jumps on and away from Finsbury Park. Renton is on automatic pilot as he alights in Hackney to get a bus to Liverpool Street. Nonetheless, he feels paranoid and self-conscious with the bag full of money. Every person looks like a potential mugger or bag snatcher to him. Whenever he sees a black leather jacket similar to Begbie's, his blood turns to ice.
He even considers going back when he is on the bus to Liverpool Street, but he sticks his hand in the bag and feels the bundles of notes. At his destination, he walks into an Abbey National branch and adds £9,000 in cash to the £27.32 already in his account. The cashier doesn't even blink. This is the city, after all. Feeling better with only £7,000 on him, Renton goes down to Liverpool Street Station and buys a return ticket to Amsterdam, only intending to go one way. He watches the county of Essex transmute from concrete and brick into lush green as they rumble out towards Harwich. He has an hour's wait at Parkston Quay before the boat sails to the Hook of Holland. This is no problem. Junkies are good at waiting. A few years back he worked on this ferry as a steward. He hopes that nobody recognizes him from those days. Renton's paranoia subsides on the boat, but it is replaced by his first real feelings of guilt. He thinks about Sick Boy and all the things they went through together. They had shared some good times, some awful times, but they had shared them. Sick Boy would recoup the cash. He was a born exploiter. It was the betrayal. He could see Sick Boy's more hurt than angry expression already. However, they had been drifting apart for years now. Their mutual antagonism, once a joke, a performance for the benefit of others, had slowly become, through being ritualized in that way, a mundane reality. It was better this way, Renton thought. In a way, Sick Boy would understand, even have a grudging admiration for his actions. His main anger would be directed at himself for not having had the bottle to do it first. It didn't take much effort to rationalize that he had done Second Prize a favor. He felt pity when he thought of Second Prize using his Criminal Injuries Compensation Board cash to front his stake. However, Second Prize was so busy destroying himself, he'd scarcely notice anyone giving him a hand. You would be as well giving him a bottle of paraquat to drink as £3,000 to spend. It would be a quicker and ultimately more painless way of killing him. Some, he considered, would argue that it was Second Prize's choice, but did not the nature of his disease destroy his capacity to make a meaningful choice? He smirks at the irony of him, a junkie who has just ripped off his best mates, pontificating in such a manner. But was he a junkie? True, he had just used again, but the gaps between his using were growing. However, he couldn't really answer this question now. Only time could do that. Renton's real guilt was centered around Spud. He loved Spud. Spud had never hurt anybody, with the exception, perhaps, of a bit of mental distress caused by his tendency to liberate the contents of people's pockets, purses, and homes. People got too het up about things, though. They invested too much emotion in objects. Spud could not be held responsible for society's materialism and commodity fetishism. Nothing had gone right for Spud. The world had shat on him, and now his mate had joined it. If there was one person whom Renton would try to compensate, it was Spud. That left Begbie. He could find no sympathy for that fucker. A psycho who used sharpened knitting needles when he went to sort some poor cunt out. Less chance of hitting the ribcage than with a knife, he'd boast. Renton recalled the time when Begbie had glassed Roy Sneddon in the Vine for fuck all. Nothing other than the guy had an irritating voice and Begbie was hungover. It was ugly, sickening, and pointless. Even uglier than the act itself was the way that they all, including Renton, had colluded with it, even to the extent of creating fictitious scenarios to justify it.
It was just another way of building Begbie's status as somebody not to mess with, and their own indirectly, through their association with him. He saw it for the extreme moral cowardice it was. Alongside this, his crime in ripping off Begbie was almost virtuous. Ironically, it was Begbie who was the key.